Hi, this is Thomas J. Pucher speaking, the president of FalconCrest.org. This is another one of my commentaries, this time to celebrate the 41st anniversary of the show's premiere. It is December the 4th of 2022, and I'd like to guide you through Climax today, which is the exciting finale of Season 2. Before we get started, I want to let you know that you can basically use our behind-the-scenes section on the website like a commentary while watching each episode. In my audio commentaries, I'll throw in some additional details here and there that are not on the website, and I'm trying to give this a more personal approach. So, put in your DVD from Warner Home Video and turn down the volume a bit. I'll tell you when to push the play button so you can listen to my audio commentary while playing the episode. Okay, so please press play now. I love the sneak preview of this episode, which gives us an idea that at least one of this year's major storylines, the Agretti murder, will be resolved. But the way it's cut, you'll see that in a couple of seconds, it leaves the audience wondering about Jacqueline's storyline and how she is connected to everything what's happening in the Tuscany Valley in this episode. Season 2 is pretty different from Season 1, which had lots of self-contained episodes besides the one integrating storyline about Jason's death that span over the whole first year. And Season 2, in contrast, went away from self-contained episodes and in particular has two core plot lines that really stand out in the serialized mode of storytelling. Number one is David Selby. Here he is in the main title. Richard Channing is one of the key additions to the show this year and will become the most important male character in the show in the long run. I'll address this topic in more detail a little bit later. And number two, Anna Alicia. I'll also say a little bit more about her later. These two characters and the way the storytelling changed in the second year were, I think, the main reasons why the show really took off. The opening scene shows us FalconCrest from above. It's some great footage from earlier filming in the Napa Valley. Since it's late in the season, this whole episode was shot in Los Angeles. So any wine country footage you see in this episode comes from the early in the season filming on distant location or from even earlier shots from the vintage years and season one. This location here is the old Pacoima Hospital in a city that is now called Lakeview Terrace in the north of Greater LA. That facility used to be the old Hillview Mental Health Institution and was a typical rent-out facility that was used by lots and lots of TV shows and movies as a filming site. In fact, this old brick building was no longer used for medical services by the mid-80s approximately, and it was exclusively leased to the entertainment industry. It suffered severe earthquake damage in the 1994 Northridge quake, and was then sealed off for decades for safety reasons until it was finally demolished in 2018. And now a residential development of single-family homes sits in its place. These lush meadows and hills on the FalconCrest grounds here are actually quite close to the hospital location. That's Bartholomew's Canyon in Sylmar, California. And it's incredible how lush they looked back then. If you go there nowadays, unfortunately, everything is really dried out and looks brown because of all the aridity, which is probably a result of global warming. And I think it really looks like the Tuscany Valley, if you remember the early season filming in the Napa Valley, because of the hills. So the location manager did a good job selecting this location. Now, this scene here is about Richard, although he isn't in there himself. But this is maybe a good time to talk a bit more about this very special character. Richard Channing is, without a doubt, the most rewritten and redeveloped regular character of the series. Earl had created him along with the original characters when he first wrote The Vintage Years, the predecessor. And Earl played around with various ideas, from Richard being Lance's older brother to Richard being Douglas Channing's son. There were several ideas if he was Douglas and Angela's son, or Douglas' son from an affair with a woman from the Valley. And for that scenario, Earl also played around with the idea that Angela had raised her stepson as her own, with the fate of Mona Donati, or Maria Donati, Richard's birth mother, a neighboring vineyardist, being rather unspecified at the time. So, when Earl finished writing the script for The Vintage Years, he decided Richard would be Douglas and Angela's son, a mercenary who comes home occasionally to assist his mother, Angie, who he is very close with. And that version of Richard was portrayed by Michael Swan in the original pilot, as you know. When it was decided that this original Richard role would be dropped, Earl reactivated his earlier ideas for Richard and waited for the right moment to bring him into the picture. Maybe to introduce him as a semi-regular first, still thinking about all the possibilities whose son Richard was, and that he might be interested in a political career. And then something highly unusual for a show like that happened. Early in the end, included him into the season finale of the first year in dialogue as Douglas' illegitimate son, which gave us, the audience, a hint that the question who Richard Channing's mother is would be an integral part of the following season. So, season two, this season, was finally the time for Richard to appear, and Earl and Bob realized it was the right decision to have him as a regular from the beginning that year. It was perfect timing because David Selby became available when Flamingo Road was canceled. That was another Lorimar show that most of you probably know. It was short-lived and lasted only two seasons. David had a season-long guest appearance as Michael Tyrone, aka Michael Edwards, in the second season of that show, and Flamingo Road really took off that year. Although the ratings were not too bad, NBC pulled the plug on it at the end of the 1981-82 television season, and so the big question in the cliffhanger, how David's character, Michael Tyrone, or Michael Edwards, survived, was never solved. And as much as I hated to see Flamingo Road being canceled, it was probably a blessing in disguise, because David was able to move over from Flamingo to Falcon. Both Lorimar shows were shot at the Burbank Studios, which is now again Warner Brothers. And along with David, many of Flamingo's staff and crew members moved over to Falcon as well, including story consultants Steve Black and Henry Stern, who had been instrumental in the development of David's devious character on Flamingo Road. David who has been a friend of mine for decades, told me in our very first interview for the fan club back in the 1990s that Michael Tyrone was kind of a blueprint for character development, because they tried to make him as dark and sinister as possible to see how far they could go and what the audience would accept. And now when the Richard role was developed for Falcon Crest, still based on Earl's original ideas, of course, Steve and Henry revived their character features for the Michael Tyrone character from Flamingo Road, but they made him a little less devious and added some more human qualities and a certain childlike vulnerability to him. So along with Earl's idea to have Richard drink milk all the time, with the notion that milk would remind Richard of his lost mother, Richard Channing became a very complex character. My personal opinion is, you know, I always thought that he was a bit underrated by the public, in contrast to maybe J.R. Ewing from Dallas, the guy the audience loved to hate. There were lots of villains in these primetime dramas, but Richard was probably the most multidimensional character of them all, because he had this very complex backstory and this desire to be loved, since he had always felt the lack of love in his life, not knowing his mother and all. Anyway, we were, I think, very fortunate that David became available, particularly because his chemistry with Jane Wyman, which was so good. And I think I can address this topic since it's not really a spoiler anymore considering the age of the series. He was great as Angela's son when it was finally revealed in seasons 6 and 7 that he was Angie's natural child. That was, by the way, a decision of Jeff Freilich, the later executive producer of the show, who looked for a way to make use of Earl's various initial ideas. One of these was that Angela had a stillborn child, and Jeff decided it was a perfect fit to revise that idea on the one hand, and to amalgamate a few elements of the various former Richard Donati concepts on the other hand into the story that Richard was abducted after childbirth, and Angela was led to believe her son died. If you want to learn more about the exciting development of the Richard Channing character, we have lots of details about Earl's original concept and the original Bibles for the first two seasons in our newsletter series, The Secret Falcon Files. So feel free to contact us if you want to get them. So, we were really fortunate to get David Selby as Richard. Some of you might know that he had a long history with Lorimar before, not only through Flamingo Road. He first worked with Earl on The Waltons, where David played Olivia Walton's art teacher, and even shared a kiss with her. And David was also Lorimar's original choice for the Gary Ewing character when Knot's Landing was developed. The part of Gary Ewing was offered to him, but David declined. And so they started having auditions and finally chose Ted Shackelford to play Gary. And when it came to Richard being cast on Falcon Crest, over 150 actors wanted to audition for the spectacular role. Only a few were invited, though. One of them was John Beck, also an ex-Flamingo Road cast member, where he played Sam Curtis. And John Beck also would later become Mark Grayson on Dallas. I'm sure almost everybody who listens to this audio commentary will know that. Another actor who auditioned for the Richard part was Michael Nader, who had already been interested in a small part in season one, Miller, the private investigator from the episode Lord of the Manor. And we all know the late Michael Nader ended up as Dex Dexter on Dynasty. Some Lorimarians, as I like to call all the veterans from Lorimore, considered William Hurt, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Tom Selleck. So this is just to give you an idea about how the casting process worked and what ideas the producers and other staff members had. And I'm actually glad Earl never seriously considered anyone else for the richer part than David Selby, because David was just perfect as Richard Channing. So this here is a scene where he is at the cartel headquarters after he was abducted the episode before. And we see him in a terrible state, also brilliantly performed by David. And it won't take long until he has the meeting with the secret number one, the secret boss of the cartel, which is a big revelation in this episode. So here we are at Hogan's Home Center, which is a location in Sylmar, California. The surroundings look totally different now because lots of buildings have been constructed across the street. Jamie Rose is in a wig here. She's actually in a wig in most of the season two episodes, starting approximately in episode 29, I think. The producers didn't like her hair being so curly, so they wanted her to wear a wig, which Jamie actually didn't like, but she finally gave in. So, when we get to the next scene, look at the steps of the veranda of the Falcon Crest Victorian Mansion. I want to let you know this in time so that so you can be prepared. Now, here it is. That's worth a few words, too. That's an exterior set. It's not the real mansion. When you are an experienced viewer, you can tell that the Falcon Crest Victorian Mansion in this scene is not the real Villa Mira Valley at Spring Mountain Vineyards in St. Helena. It's almost the end of the season, and filming on distant location was only done in the early episodes each year until season 7. So this is really the set built at the studio. And when you look at the steps from the driveway to the veranda, it's one step less than in the real house. That's one of the differences, and also the elaborate tiles on the floor in the recessed entryway are missing in the replica on the soundstage. However, I think Lorimore's set designers did an incredible job anyway. The replicated stained glass in the front doors, which we also see on the inside of the house, but also on the exterior is the exposed stonework and these very elaborate veranda pillars and banisters. That was all built on stage one at the Burbank Studios, or now Warner Brothers. It's a huge stage, and the set was arranged in a way that even bigger vehicles like Chase's pickup truck in this scene could pull up on the imaginary driveway, when they drove onto the soundstage through its huge elephant door. You know, they call these huge sliding doors elephant doors at movie studios because they are so tall and so wide that even an elephant would fit into the soundstage. So if you want to take a look at the blueprints of the sets, you can go to the show production office filming locations section on our website. And as a member, you can get full access to the original floor plans of the sets and even some of the sound stages, which is very interesting. The Tuscany County Building. That's one of the very traditional sets on Midwest Street at the Burbank Studios or Warner Brothers. It was used a lot during the first three seasons when the show filmed at Warner Brothers. And it's actually the biggest structure on the western end of Midwest Street on the studio's backlot. It has no official name, but that building is mostly referred to as the Brick Courthouse Building. It's a pretty old structure and may be remembered for its predominant use in The Music Man from 1962 and later the TV show The Dukes of Hazzard, for example. The Dukes filmed basically every episode on the backlot of Warner Brothers, so it's visible quite often. And more recent productions include Gilmore Girls, where that building was Stars Hollow High School. The structure still stands, but it was remodeled around 2010, I think. And the front part of the entryway was removed. So originally, like on Falcon Crest, there were two Ionic columns in a row on each side of the recessed entrance, plus one rectangular column on each side. This whole construction had a decorative centerpiece at the top where the prop masters would install a sign with a building name depending on whatever the current production needed. So here on Falcon Crest, they put the lettering Tuscany County Building up there. But this whole outer part of the entryway was removed. But that was, if you ask me, obviously not a wise decision from an architectural standpoint because it left the remainder of the building look flat and shallow. So, by the way, if you want to learn more about the movie studios where Falcon Crest was filmed, we have a travel guide in four volumes. And one volume deals with the two studios where Falcon Crest was shot. The first one was Warner Brothers Studios, which was used for seasons 1 through 3. And the second one was CBS Studio Center, where the remainder of the show was filmed. And that volume of our travel guide also covers a lot of the history of these studios. So here's also a big revelation. Nick is still in love with Sheila, or at least has sex with her. I think the producers wanted to get as many thrilling parts into the storyline for that final episode of the season. And after such a long build of the storyline of the romance between Nick and Vicky, this is really kind of a shocking twist. So here, we are back at one of the core storylines this season, Richard. And not only the question about his true identity and his relationship to the Gioberti Channing family was one of the key elements, but also, of course, his involvement with a cartel. Oh, this set, by the way, is the redressed set of Richard's New Globe office and its anteroom. Such tricks are necessitated not only by the budget, but also because you have only a certain area where you can film. In this case, Falcon Crest usually used stages 1 and 19A at the Burbank Studios, which are now numbers 1, still the same, and 19 at Warner Brothers. Unless it's absolutely necessary, you usually stay on those stages, so the crew constantly has to rearrange existing sets and redress them for multiple use. And there is actually a funny story one of my friends from the crew shared with me years ago. Carmen Gallia was the paint foreman in the construction department of the series. And he and his painters were on standby on the set in case something was damaged during filming or something needed to be touched up for other reasons. And despite Lorimore's attempts to save on production cost wherever they could, they exchanged the carpet when this set was redressed from the New Globe executive office to Jacqueline's office in New York City. And since it was a one-time only redress, the company wanted to dispose of the carpet after the scene was filmed. And my friend Carmen had just moved into a new apartment at the time, and he asked his supervisor if he could keep that carpet, and Lorimore agreed. And it was so huge that he was able to cover all the floors in his new home. So, one of the positive side effects. But back to the storyline now. When I did my first interview with Steve and Henry back in 2008, I learned that it was their idea to utilize Lana Turner as the secret head of the cartel. And I think it was brilliant. But it's quite funny how all things fell into place. You know, Lana's contract for season 2 guaranteed her 5 episodes. And the season was slowly coming to its end. And there was still one of her episodic assignments left. So Henry and Steve came up with the idea to use that to their advantage and making Jacqueline the cartel's secret boss would bring another dimension to Richard's life. And Earl was thrilled about the idea. By the way, the idea of the adoption and of Henri Deneau's past as a Nazi collaborator was primarily influenced by script consultants Stephen Black and Henry Stern, too. So they really had a lot to do with not only the redevelopment of the character, but also how he would fit into multiple storylines. And it really worked very, very well. So this here is a funny scene shortly before Jacqueline phones and her call comes in from New York. What basically happens here is more like background action, and it creates a great atmosphere of normal life in the Gioberti household. And the fact that it's Vicky's wedding day makes it even funnier. So here, it's like a very normal family. There is some hectic in the morning of the wedding in the Gioberti house. The bride is not really hungry. There was a little bit of small talk. And I really love that moment when Cole is putting all of Vicky's food on his plate, which is really hilarious. And then Jacqueline's phone call comes in. We also realize that there is some tension and nervousness among the Gioberti family members. And that is really something that shows us how the rich vintners are actually not that much different from the ordinary people. So we see here a backdrop of New York behind Jacqueline. The set designers added a big matte painting. Breakfast at Falcon Crest. So Melissa is here. So now that I talked so much about Richard, I also want to address Anna Alicia, this beauty here, the second edition as a regular this season. And I think we have a couple of minutes to look at her character in detail. Her character was introduced in season one already, as you know. But first being played by Dolores Cantu in the episode For Love or Money, where the producers thought of her as a one-time-only guest appearance. But, you know, season one was kind of a let's feel our way along season, which is typical of the first year of the show. And when the producers later tried out the role again for the remainder of season one, beginning in House of Cards, now with Anna Alicia taking over the part, the producers realized that this character had really great potential. And at the same time, Anna Alicia became incredibly popular with the audience. And the writers began to write to all these strengths that the actress brought along. The producers realized that she was a mirror-like image of Angie, a young mirror-like image. And as a result, Melissa became a regular in season two, and a little backstory was added which would grow over time. And while Anna Alicia had such great potential, the show, I think, really took off with her in season two. Angie mistakenly feels in the beginning that she has nothing to fear from Melissa, but she doesn't realize that Melissa's ultimate ambition is to replace her. And that's something the producers gradually developed over the next few years. Also by adding more and more to Melissa's backstory, including the century-long Agretti-Gioberti feud. And so it was basically Anna Alicia's great performance that led to the further development of this very special character. So this is interesting. This scene here is actually the second time they filmed it. There was an alternate version of the scene here in Angie's study, and it was filmed with a different hairdo for Anna Alicia and a flower in her hair. And we just published a still photo from that version in the behind-the-scenes section on our website. So, to integrate Anna Alicia, or Melissa, even more into the storyline, the murder of her father was developed. That was a point in the story that had not been planned when the Bible was written by Bob McCullough and Earl. And it was basically added when Steve Black and Henry Stern became attached to story consultants because they early recognized Melissa's value for the plot. So here we are at the wedding of Vicky Gioberti and Nick Hogan. Original script drafts called for Father Bob to marry Vicky and Nick, but fortunately the writers realized early enough that Nick could not marry in the Roman Catholic Church a second time because of his marriage to Sheila. The Catholic Church does not acknowledge the civil divorce of marriage and still regards Nick and Sheila as married. Since this is apparently a Protestant pastor here, the scene subtly suggests that Nick is a member of the Protestant Church, eliminating the problem. And I think it was a nice idea to rehire Stanley Grover, who played the pastor in season one already during Bill Reed and Ann Hilton's funeral. And the same supporting characters appearing here and there over the years is always something that adds to the authenticity of the environment. The rural surroundings in the Tuscany Valley where everybody knows almost everyone else. So, the later it is in the season, the more difficult it becomes to deliver authentic outdoor scenes in the wine country. And as you know, filming in Northern California occurred in the summer only. So, only the first 10 episodes of season 2 contain Napa Valley scenes. And it's not always easy to find locations that resemble particularly the Falcon Crest Victorian mansion. That's why the original script for this episode suggested that much more of the reception, if not all, take place inside the house. And it would certainly have been easier to shoot all that at the studio, but on the other hand, the producers were very much aware of the fact that the wine country locations, even by that time, had already become one of the hallmarks of the show. And at the same time, they were aware of the need for exterior shots to avoid the episode looking too interior. And that's why the location manager had to come up with something that would kind of resemble the surroundings of the mansion. And that's the reason why Vicky and Nick's wedding takes place in the Rose Garden of Falcon Crest, which we are led to believe is somewhere around the Victorian mansion. So illusion is everything on the screen. Actually, this here is an LA-based location. It's the Rose Garden at the Los Angeles County Arboretum and Botanic Garden in Arcadia. And it really fits the purpose quite well. Richard coming back to the Tuscany Valley. Oh, Mary-Kate McGeehan is here in the picture. And I think they really included her nicely into the family, because this is actually the first time when she is fully integrated as Cole's new girlfriend here at Vicky and Nick's wedding. Mary-Kate is an adorable lady. She's very beautiful, and I think she played Linda as a really great down-to-earth person. A very good match for Cole. So we're still here at the Rose Garden. And Angela is visibly shaken by Richard's presence. She had already thought that he would be gone forever. So we're getting close to the season finale now. Here is guest star James Hong, who plays Charles Fong. And he will serve as the key to the identification of the killer, as you all know. So that gives us a little bit of time to talk about the Agretti murder storyline, because one of the most asked questions around and around the fan community is when it was decided that Julia would be selected as the murderess in the Carlo Agretti case. Well, there is no exact documentation for that. And one must know that even if a storyline is developed in the seasonal Bible, that story meetings of the writing and producing staff while the season is produced, and while some of the episodes are already on the air, these story meetings oftentimes lead to changes in the development and to rewrites of scripts. And in this case, things are even more complicated because the Agretti murder was not even part of the original Bible, which is kind of surprising in retrospect because it became such an integral part of season two. Anyway, the great Bob McCullough, who wrote this episode and who was the actual showrunner during the first three seasons, later said that he started thinking about who the killer could be towards maybe the last third of the season or so. Of course, the writers and producers tried to make it difficult for the audience to guess. And they also set the viewers on the wrong track a couple of times. So, for example, if you think about the episode entitled Above Suspicion, which is the 14th episode of the season. The producers had a few characters wear very similar gray knit sweaters, resembling the one we saw on the gloved hand and arm when Carlo was murdered early in the season. And we also have a collection of screen grabs of these wool fabric sweaters in our behind-the-scenes section for Above Suspicion on our website. As you may know, Bob wrote and the crew filmed various confession scenes, so nobody would know in advance which character would be revealed as Carlo's murderer. And it was also kept a secret from the cast and almost all staff members because Lorimar wanted to avoid the surprise to be spoiled by someone playing it to the press. Our members have access to the Chao Li Chi Memorial Library, where various drafts of the script for Climax are stored. And also we have excerpts of the confession scenes, actually of the various characters confessing, in our behind-the-scenes section for this episode for the general public. So, when I interviewed Garner Simmons, who was one of the story editors in Season 2 for Volume 5 of our Falcon Cresters Tell It All magazine, he shared that not even CBS knew who the killer would be, although network executives had given their input in prior discussions with Lorimar. And just minutes before broadcasting, Lorimar delivered the final print of the episode to CBS Television City in Hollywood the night when it would originally be aired. And they sent the episode to New York via satellite at the last minute, where it aired first due to the different time zones. Abby herself was the only cast member who was informed by Bob that afternoon. Oh, this is interesting. Lana Turner's appearance here. Lana's segments were actually the last scenes to be filmed for this season. They were filmed on February the 8th of 1983, and only Susan, Joe Lambie, James Hong, and Foxworth were present. The confession scenes with all the other characters confessing were already shot the day before, on February the 7th of 1983. And Lana wasn't there, of course. She was only there on February the 8th. So Chase finally arrives with Robbins, and, you know, it was very important to have the murder case solved, but I think the writers understood very well how to connect this subtly with Chase's egotistic nature. As good as it was that someone went after the murderer or murderess, the audience realizes now what setting priorities meant for Chase. Solving the murder case was definitely more important for Chase than his daughter's wedding. Chase's quest for the truth, his uncompromising way of doing things his way, no matter how his family may feel about it, is a result of his stubbornness and hot-headedness. And in that respect, writer and supervising producer Bob McCullough did something very important again. He wrote the Chase character with many different features and aspects, and he avoided making him a hero. So Chase has a lot of flaws, and his self-righteousness is definitely one of them. And the fact that this will totally backfire at the end of the season and will leave Chase in a hospital bed next season, which is not even nearly as horrible as what will happen to Jacqueline, is some wonderful dramatic irony Bob included in the storyline. So, the confession scene here. Many parts of the scenes with the other characters confessing were used in the editing process for the final version, particularly for all the reaction shots. And needless to say that these frames that were placed into the final cut created some continuity errors that you will notice if you watch very carefully. And we have a lot of details about those continuity mistakes in the behind-the-scenes section on our website. So, and here, Julia is revealed as the murderess. It was a big, shocking revelation back then, but I think it was brilliant because it was so unexpected. And I also loved that they didn't send her away to rot in prison, but that they kept her with exciting storylines for some of the following seasons. That's really something Falcon Crest was very good at, because I'm sure lots of other shows would have just disposed of the character. So I really liked what they did with her, and it kept it realistic in a way. Although it was such a big, big surprise. And speaking of surprises, she has one more just for Chase. The exterior shots of the mansion are generic shots taken on location in the Napa Valley at the beginning of the season or in the previous year, so that explains why neither Chase's car nor the sheriff's patrol car or any other cars of the reception guests are visible anywhere on the driveway. And here's the final scene. Who's in the coffin? That was the big question for the summer of 1983. Okay, and the end credits are rolling. I'd like to thank you for revisiting the season 2 finale with me, and I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know your thoughts on this audio commentary, and feel free to reach out to us via email at production.office@falconcrest.org with any questions you might have. And if you were on the cast, staff, or crew and would like to catch up with your old friends, you can also drop us a message so we can get you reconnected through our cast and crew network. I'm Thomas J. Pucher, president of FalconCrest.org. Thank you so much for your interest, and until next time, bye-bye.